This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. General Manuel Noriega, the former military ruler of Panama, is in solitary confinement in the Dade County, Florida jail. He's awaiting trial on drug trafficking charges. The trial was recently postponed to late fall. It was less than 3 months ago, on December 20th, that the U.S. invaded Panama to remove Noriega from power and to enforce two separate drug trafficking indictments against him. As journalist John Dingus writes, never before had the U.S. indicted a foreign official of Noriega's rank and power. The charges against Noriega were even more astounding in light of his history of close cooperation with the U.S. in military intelligence and drug enforcement matters. Dingus reconstructs the history of that cooperation in his new book, Our Man in Panama. John Dingus is a foreign editor at National Public Radio. He's also co-author of a book on the murder of Chilean diplomat Orlando Letelier called Assassination on Embassy Row. I asked Dingus to sum up what Panama's role has been in the Latin American drug trade.
Panama is a transshipment point for everything, blue jeans to drugs to espionage equipment. That's the essence of the country ever since Balboa walked over the isthmus and discovered the Pacific Ocean. It's a place where you take things and move them around. And so it's a natural for drugs. In the early 70s, it was well known that Panama was a link in the French connection. The drugs were coming from the east, France, through South America, and then up through Panama to the United States, a very circuitous route, but one that, of course, had the advantage of confusing detection. And it's at that time that Noriega first gets into the drug trade, and he was actually detected by the United States in 1971, 1972.
Panama has also had bank secrecy laws that makes it easy for drug money to be laundered there.
That happened around the same time that Omar Torrijos took over in a coup in 1968, and it actually was a very progressive government, introduced social reforms, and generally was considered to be a fairly good thing for Panama. One of the things that they did, and of course this was with U.S. encouragement, was to build up a banking center, to have bank laws that would guarantee secrecy and set up a system similar to what you have in Switzerland, the Cayman Islands, Jamaica, those kinds of things. And this is not set up to launder drug money. It's set up to be a tax haven. And, of course, you have any kind of money from skimming at the Las Vegas casinos to off-track betting in New York. Any place where you have a lot of cash to get rid of, people tend to put it in banks like this to avoid paying taxes on it. Drug money was just one more source of cash, and the system was set up for it. And as soon as the cash was there, they started using it.
What has Noriega's personal involvement been that we know of in drugs?
In the early days, he was the man. This is 1971-72. He had taken over as head of intelligence, so he was in charge of immigration, the drug police. And so if you wanted protection to bring in a load of marijuana or to ship it out, you had to pay off Noriega. And so at that point, he was taking fairly direct payoffs. This is a fairly short period of time, but that's the kind of thing he would do. He was never somebody that would actually order a shipload of marijuana or a plane load of cocaine. He was always somebody you had to pay off to do your drug business, so it wasn't that kind of hands-on direct involvement.
But he made a lot of money off of drugs.
He made probably fairly piddling amounts, tens of thousands of dollars, that sort of thing, in the early 70s. And probably wasn't at all something that was his major field of endeavor. He, as I say in the book, he's made a lot more from other kinds of corruption, making foreign businessmen pay off to do business in Panama for using the Canal Free Zone, all sorts of things like that. Arms trafficking, he made a lot of money in arms trafficking. It was always something that he was involved in as one of the things that is easy to do if you're a general in charge of intelligence in a country like Panama. In the 80s, then drugs becomes a billion-dollar business. And at that point, Noriega jumps into the trade again using the network he'd already set up for arms trafficking and begins to make not tens of thousands of dollars but millions of dollars.
John Dingus is my guest, and he's a foreign editor at NPR and author of the new book, Our Man in Panama, about General Noriega. Nate, you say in spite of Noriega's involvement in the drug trade, he's hardly the drug kingpin that Bush has made him out to be.
Well, we're looking at a case in which the United States has invaded a country in order to enforce an indictment to bring this man to trial in Miami. Now, that may or may not be a good thing. The politics of that we're going to be debating for years. But if you look at it just as a drug case, this is a man whose maximum involvement, as documented in the U.S. case, is maybe $10 million in drug payoffs. This is nowhere near the involvement of the Ochoas, the Escobars in Colombia, the many, many major drug traffickers who are generating profits of $2 or $3 billion a year. So one has to wonder at the proportion of the response for somebody like Noriega. My feeling, my theory is that, it's not a theory, it's more of an observation, is that we demonized Noriega. We created him as such a terrible, evil man that it was that he personally, his personal evil was used to justify an invasion in which hundreds of lives were lost. And I think that was a terrible misperception of U.S. policy, misapplication of U.S. power.
Well, do you think that drugs are being used to cover up other stories that Noriega has been involved with?
I think that, I don't know if it's a cover-up. It would be hard to assume that there was a cover-up since we actually brought him here and we're going to put him on trial. Many people think that the invasion was targeted on Noriega personally, certainly it was, and that if he had been caught in a firefight and been killed, that would not have been regretted too much within the U.S. Policy planners. It would have been much more convenient if this man had died in the fighting than for him to have turned himself in and basically demanded a trial and the opportunity to reveal the secret that he's learned during a 30-year relationship with U.S. intelligence.
Well, Noriega helped ship arms to the Contras. Do you think there's any connection between Noriega and the Iran-Contra affair?
I think that Noriega had a peripheral connection in the Iran-Contra affair. As you remember from the evidence that came out in the hearings, Panama was the place where the companies were set up that were used in the Iran-Contra transactions. That, of course, doesn't say much because there are 100,000 secret companies set up in Panama all the time. The fact that there was this kind of protection for those kinds of operations is significant. It means that there was a direct contact with the United States. Panama was a place you could depend on to do the setup for the Iran-Contra transactions. I think, however, the most interesting thing is going to be that Noriega, as the intelligence man, was in the catbird seat during all this period of time, during all the 80s, when all of this illegal activity was going on by the United States, the off-the-books government activities. He was in a perfect position to observe what was going on. If anybody knows the real truth of Iran-Contra, it may be General Noriega. And he has a lot of stories to tell, but as a good intelligence man, he has not told them yet. If he really knows those stories, he's holding them to the point where they'll be most useful, most powerful to use against the United States government.
John Dinges is my guest, and he's a foreign editor at National Public Radio and author of a new book about Noriega called Our Man in Panama. Now, you suggest that the United States used Noriega in the war against communism at the expense of the war against drugs. I mean, now here we are, you know, about to put him on trial for his involvement in the drug trade. And well, you're saying that the United States kind of let him participate in drug deals because we were using him in the war against communism.
The big question is, why did it take so long for us to turn against Noriega?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer, to my mind, is that he was very useful to us in our ideological crusade in Central America. I kind of draw a little picture to illustrate this. Every U.S. agency is represented in Panama, the Pentagon, the CIA, the military intelligence, the embassies, the Drug Enforcement Administration. All of these people are in Panama in the 1980s, but they're not looking at Panama. They're standing there with their back to the country, looking at El Salvador, looking at Guatemala, looking at Nicaragua, Honduras, the drug enforcement people, not looking at Panama, they're looking at Colombia. Nobody's paying attention to what's going on under their own feet. And their major agenda is not Panama, it's the war on communism, the war on Nicaragua. And so the willingness to look the other way when suspicions came up about Noriega was very high. And for years and years after Noriega's, after the charges came out against Noriega, the United States didn't really make an effort to investigate them. In fact, as I tell the story in the book, it's a fascinating picture of low-level law enforcement agents in the Drug Enforcement Administration who get a lead, follow it up, and eventually develop this enormous case against Noriega. It wasn't something that was ordered from the top. Somebody that said, this man is bad. This man we have to investigate. Give me everything you've got. Let's really put all stops out. We've got to find out whether this man is really involved in drugs and run down the suspicions. That's not the way it was. It was police work. And eventually one source led to another, and over a period of several years, we caught the man. It took from the time that, and by the way, I also point out that Noriega's drug trafficking is cyclical. After 1985, there's really no more evidence that is strong that he was involved in significant transshipment of cocaine, that those kind of big protection payments from the cartel. So in other words, by the time we catch him for what he did in 82, 83, 84, he hasn't been doing it for 3 or 4 years.
Were you describing all these Americans using Panama not to pay attention to what's happening in Panama, but to have a listening post for other Central American countries? Noriega let the United States do that. He let the United States have CIA operations based in Panama in violation of the Panama Canal Treaty.
And he was cooperating with those. He was part of those operations. He was getting several hundred thousand dollars a year for those kinds of joint operations through his G2 Intelligence Command and the CIA. There was an enormous amount of cooperation. That's why even though he was considered to be unsavory and a lot of people kind of laughed at him because he was this ugly little man, still he was so useful that that they went along with him.
Well, our President George Bush is a former head of the CIA. What's the history of Bush's relationship with Noriega? Noriega was the head of intelligence in his country, Bush the head of intelligence here.
Yeah, you can go back to 1976, the year that Bush was head of the CIA. What's happening in Panama? The United States, for the first time, this is the Ford administration, has gotten serious about canal negotiations. We're moving fairly rapidly toward a treaty. The trouble is that Ronald Reagan is running for president, and he is saying, we bought it, we paid for it, it's ours. And leading a conservative charge against the treaties, Panama tries to increase the turn up the pressure. There are some bombings in the canal zone. The first time that there's terrorist activities inside the canal zone, obviously to demonstrate to the United States, if you don't sign a treaty with us, there's going to be hell to pay. You're going to have a hard time protecting this canal because we can do this anytime we want. U.S. intelligence identifies Noriega's men as the ones who carried out these bombings. So Noriega comes up to Washington to meet with George Bush to, essentially, to answer to this. But George Bush's only real concern is, are you a communist? Is Omar Torrijos a communist? And given those assurances that they are ideological friends, and Noriega gives assurances, well, we didn't do it, but we won't do it again in terms of the bombings, and they part friends. Now, at this time, George Bush is the director of Central Intelligence. I list a whole variety of reports that were available to him, including a report that Noriega had penetrated U.S. Espionage operations in Panama and had taken the entire set of transcripts of U.S. bugging operations in Panama and had and knew exactly everything that had been intercepted by the United States. Some people think he even turned some of this information over to Cuba. So it was extremely compromising because he was able to figure out who we were spying on all over Latin America. That was known to Bush at the time of that meeting. And as we all know, the relationship did not change an iota between the Central Intelligence Agency and Noriega.
Do you think that anything will come out of the Noriega trial that will embarrass Bush?
I think a lot that will come out will be embarrassing to the administration. Not necessarily about George Bush personally, because the extent of their personal relationship, I think, is probably quite small, except for the case I just described to you. But Noriega's ability to embarrass the United States, to reveal details of our skullduggery in Central America for the past 10 years, I think is very great. I think he has a big chest of documents squirreled away of information that could be very compromising for the United States. This is information, I think, that will be on the order of the Iran-Contra revelations.
Well, then why do you think that Bush gave his permission for the invasion of Panama and for the putting of Noriega on trial, knowing that the administration really stands to be very embarrassed by the information that comes out?
Well, I think it's one more example of the marvelous ways in which the United States government operates. For better or for worse, it is a system that kind of operates according to the rules in spite of itself in many cases. It wasn't George Bush that indicted Manuel Noriega. It was a U.S. attorney, Leon Kellner, down in Miami. And for a variety of circumstances, it was very difficult for anybody higher up in the administration to say, well, sure, you've got the evidence on him, but let's not indict him for national security reasons. It was impossible, given the climate of the country, coming on the heels of the Iran-Contra affair, even coming on the heels of a spectacular case in which the very U.S. attorney, Leon Kellner, had been accused of having gone easy on some Iran-Contra indictments. It would have been impossible for the United States, for the presidency, to have said, oh, well, Leon Kellner, let's go easy on Noriega. He's only a drug trafficker, but national security is more important. It was circumstantially impossible. We had to enforce this case in order to preserve the integrity of the U.S. system.
Let me get back to Noriega's trial for a moment. Since there is this possibility that information that would really embarrass the administration would come out during the trial, do you think there's any chance that there'll be a plea bargain or something like that would prevent the type of interrogation that would release this information?
Certainly that's a possibility. I don't think there's... this would mean that Noriega would go along with this. So we would have to offer him a pretty good deal. How much jail time would this man have to serve in order to keep quiet? That's a really interesting question. How little jail time could the administration get away with offering him in exchange for his silence that would not in itself be so outrageous that the American people would react against it? You will have noticed that the administration has not ruled out a plea bargain, and I find that very interesting.
Is there a moral of the story here in how the United States handled Noriega?
Well, I think this is an amorality tale. The United States has no high moral ground in dealing with Noriega. We dealt with this man. We paid him. We used him. He used us. And then for us to then suddenly say that because of his crimes, he's the blackest soul in all of Latin America deserving of an invasion, I think is rank hypocrisy. Noriega, on the other hand, is somebody whose actions are indefensible. Notwithstanding his particular crimes, the fact that he held on to power, that he would not compromise, that he led his country down the path until first to economic ruin because of the standing up to the U.S. sanctions, and then finally provoking an invasion that he could have avoided by negotiating his way out of power 6 months, a year earlier. There was no outcome, and he basically took his country down to ruin along with himself. And I think that his own country, even those who might be favorably disposed to the military, will judge him very harshly for that.
John, you recently got back from Panama. You were there 2 weeks ago. What's the legacy of the U.S. invasion of Panama for the people there?
Well, the signs of the invasion are everywhere. The country is essentially paralyzed commercially, and particularly in Panama City and in Colón, the two largest cities. Almost 50% of the stores are still closed because of the looting that was rampant after the invasion. U.S. troops are patrolling the streets in concert with some of the members of the Panama Defense Forces. Essentially, the U.S., it looks... When you see it, it looks like the Americans are guarding the Panamanians who are guarding the streets. no one trusts the Panamanian Defense Forces. They're very afraid of the United States leaving. It seems to me like this is an occupation that's going to go on for quite a while. At the same time, the demand for U.S. aid is very, very, very high. The Panamanians applaud us, but they hold us responsible for bringing them back on their feet. 12,000 people lost their homes in the middle of Panama City. Those people are holed up at a refugee camp in an old airport hangar, a U.S. air base. They are sitting there now 2 months, eating two meals a day. They're very anxious to get their homes back. They say the United States has to give us our homes back. The important thing to also keep in mind in my observations in Panama is a mood of optimism in the country. People are quite upbeat, even though unemployment is rampant. Many people still have not gone back to work because the shops aren't open again. But still, they feel that they've gotten through this nightmare, that it's over, that the country is going to pull itself back together with U.S. help, and that it really is going to work out okay. I mean, people are very optimistic and certainly much happier. It was a very bitter country in my previous trips before the invasion, and bitter whichever side of the political spectrum you were on. People were very unhappy, and now equally on both sides of the spectrum, people are much more optimistic.
Now that Noriega's gone. Well, John Dinges, thank you very much for talking with us about Noriega.
You're welcome. It's nice talking to you.
John Dinges is a foreign editor at National Public Radio and author of a new book about Noriega called Our Man in Panama. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.